Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. A global financial contagion is spreading to all shores. But if you rewind the tape, it leads back to one main source, American housing and home lending. The $14 trillion mortgage industry has huge problems. If it's going to revive, it needs new rules. Everyone agrees there. But a giant debate looms on how the rules should be rewritten. In the balance, the fate of millions of homeowners, present and future, and with them, the long-term stability of the U.S., maybe the world economy. This hour, On Point, your home and your money, housing, banking, and the rules of the game. You can join the conversation. What new rules should be in place? Should we make it harder to buy a home? Should we stop banks from playing with mortgage securities? Will we still have finance if we do? In a moment, we will hear from Susan Wachter and Dwight Jaffe, two big real estate finance experts. But joining me first from London for a look at the now world economic crisis is Philip Coggan, capital markets editor for The Economist magazine. Philip, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tom.
Any sign of things easing? Brutal day or two and more now. But any sign of a corner, a floor?
A little sign has come with the Federal Reserve announcing that it's going to buy commercial paper. Now, that sounds a bit obscure, but the problem that we've had in recent days is that with banks not lending to anyone, then companies have found it difficult to raise finance. And if that goes on for very long, the whole economy could really grind to a halt. So the Fed has stepped in to say that it will create a new facility, after all the other ones we've had, to buy this commercial paper, the money that short-term debt that companies issue, and that has restored a bit of confidence to the markets.
So you're sitting in London watching what the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank is doing in the United States. Huge American companies like Caterpillar, General Electric, McDonald's having trouble getting their normal everyday credit needs met, never mind small businesses. And that may make the difference for the U.K., for Europe? Is it still that dependent on the U.S., or do you have a European-based crisis as well now?
We certainly do have a European-based crisis. Just today, another bank in Iceland has been nationalized, and that may sound slightly trivial, but it is a big deposit taker in the U.K. 300,000 Britons have suddenly found their savings frozen because of that. There's also talks between our government and some of the leading banks about injecting new money into them, and we are still seeing the aftershocks of the decisions at the weekend from governments to say that they will guarantee deposits in various countries around Europe. We've had a bit of a mess, really, with different governments saying different things. It's given the impression of being totally disorganized. The finance ministers of the 27 countries in the European Union are meeting today, and hopefully they can come out with something that is a bit more coherent and covers the whole continent.
They're talking about a guarantee, something like U.S. bank depositors have with the FDIC, $100,000 here going up much higher after last week's bailout package. And will there be a common standard for Europe? Is that what they're aiming for on that scale?
Well, hopefully there will be a common standard. I mean, what the Irish did a week ago was to guarantee all deposits without limit. And, of course, this raises the stakes for other governments, because if you have a choice between a British bank, where you're only covered up to £50,000, about $100,000 here, you might choose to send your money to Ireland instead, where all your money's covered. So the danger is a sort of beggar my neighbour policy, where money flows across borders in search of the country with the best guarantee. So they're trying to sort out a policy to avoid that. And, of course, that's not the only problem we face. As well as the deposit guarantee, there's this whole question of having our banks the same problem as yours, where they have these troubled assets, mortgage-related assets on their balance sheet, and they need more money from the government to try and help them out.
Philip, you watch capital markets right around the world. Is there any region, any major economy that has appeared to be immune to this or recovering more quickly?
Not really. When we've seen a huge fall on the Chinese stock market, for example, Russia had to suspend its stock market again yesterday. It fell 19%. Brazil's had to suspend its stock market. Commodity prices have fallen sharply. That's bad news for developing countries around the world. And of course, if the U.S. economy goes into recession, if Europe does, then exporters in Asia and Latin America will suffer. So I'm afraid we're all in this together.
And where are people looking now for some reassurance or relief? Can it come from the EU alone, for the EU? Does it have to come from the United States? Does it have to be something that spans the Atlantic and the Pacific? Is there a forum big enough, mighty enough, united enough to face this among governments?
Well, there are meetings like the G7, which is the leading seven economies in the world. I think we're going to have interest rate cuts from more than one country. Australia cut its interest rates by a full percentage point today, and there's talk that the Bank of England will do the same on Thursday, and a lot of speculation that the Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank will have to follow suit. So if we get a combination of schemes, guaranteeing deposits, sticking money into banks, and cutting interest rates, that might just be enough to turn around confidence.
Everybody's in trouble, but everybody is also, it now seems, in gear. We'll be watching closely. Philip Coggan, Capital Markets Editor for The Economist, joining us from London. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
We're talking today about American housing and finance. Joining me are two big thinkers in the field of real estate finance. Susan Wachter is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. Professor Wachter, thanks very much for being here.
Pleasure.
And Dwight Jaffe is a professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He is a visiting professor at New York University right now. Professor Jaffe, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
Susan, it's hard to know where to begin here, except it all seems to come back to American housing and lending practices. Why? How? How could that be such a big factor in what now looks like a global meltdown?
The securitization process, which expanded credit beyond levels we've ever seen before in the United States, also distributed and diffused this bad credit, toxic credit. If only a portion was supposed to be, but it all is, because it's all now in doubt, throughout the world. So there is uncertainty, counterparty risk, a lack of trust now literally throughout the world.
Dwight Jaffe, does it mean that during all these years when we were all amazed at what piggy banks our homes had become, values going up and up, people borrowing against that and feeling flush because of that, and planning retirements and much more based on the value of those homes, was that all an illusion?
It sure was. Real estate cycles and boom-bust cycles in particular of the sort we've just experienced are not that uncommon. In different kinds of real estate, there have been numerous cycles of this form. It's only the latest and obviously an extremely severe and unhappy experience, but it's perfectly common.
So, Susan, nationally then, how much has the housing market fallen? And I no one can say, of course, it's a market, but does it feel as though we've wrung that sort of illusory value out of it, or, you know, purported value, or do we still have to chunk down some big percentage before we find a floor and can start rebuilding here?
Well, the real issue is that we certainly overshot on the way up, and we can overshoot on the way down, too. And as we overshoot on the way down, pull down the entire, even global economy with us, plunging into a different set of fundamentals where, really grim fundamentals, where we are in a severe recession.
Do you think we're overshooting? Yes.
Yeah, let me directly answer your question. Mm-hmm. If we were based on the fundamentals of the housing market, we would not be that far from a bottom. Prices have already fallen 20, depending on the market and depending on what index, but let's say 20%. Another 10%, 5, 10%, and based on long-term fundamentals, we probably would be there, which gives us a way out, I believe, some hope for a way out of this if we can avoid the overshooting on the downside.
Dwight Jaffe, how do you calculate the fundamentals of a bottom when an economy itself may be contracting?
I think you really cannot. In other words, the fundamentals are conditional on the state of the economy. And so if we are, say, about to go into a very severe recession, I think one has to expect that we are not at the bottom of the house price cycle. If the economy goes into a very soft recession, then, as Susan said, we may pretty much be there. I would also add that real estate, of course, is local, and so there's going to be very large regional variations within the United States as to when the bottom is reached. In some of the sector, say, in my home state of California, where we had a lot of subprime lending and therefore a lot of foreclosures, they may well be at the bottom, whereas there may be other areas that haven't taken the declines as yet, but a very deep recession would surely mean there's more to come.
Susan, we're going
to... That's exactly why we have to, we don't avoid recessions throughout the history. Recessions come and go. You don't see the Fed saying, we have a recession, we'll pull out all stops, we'll stop it. But at this point in time, the fundamentals of the housing market absolutely depend on the fundamentals of the overall economy and vice versa. So that's the potential maelstrom of destruction of this negative feedback interaction. But at today's mild recession, almost recession, which people, where we're in now, and mild recession to come, we could be almost there already and get out of this potentially without a severe recession beyond what we've seen since the Great Depression.
Dwight Jaffe, we get a sense of where, how Susan sees it. Do you see that also as a real possibility, even likelihood, or wishful thinking?
I more or less agree with Susan on that.
Thank goodness. I'm not sure what else to say there, but thank goodness, because the bottom was looking awfully deep there for a minute. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about American housing and finance. What went wrong and how to fix it? Dwight Jaffe of UC Berkeley, and now NYU, joins us from New York. Susan Wachter from the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, professor of finance and real estate there, is here. I'm going to go to regulation, but we have so many callers already. Rachel in Milan, Illinois. Rachel, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was wondering, it seems like trust is the problem, and the only way we can start to trust each other is if we really know the value of all these things that are out there. Do you think the United States will be the first government that has the courage to say, okay, bring everything out to the light of the day, let's give it a market value, and then start dealing with the problem?
And this goes right to the challenge, of course, now that the bailout coordinators are facing in Washington. What value to put on the assets they're going to take over? Susan Wachter, what about that? Is it possible now to open the cupboards, open the closets, as Rachel says, value everything according to what it is right now, and get a clean start that way?
The problem is that the value depends on the future states of the economy, on how deep a recession, whether we have a recession, and how we value, how we deal with these unpriceable assets right this moment, how we deal with the assets will affect the future of the overall economy. So the two are related. This is a very difficult problem on some level, unsolvable by the math, because we don't know the future, and today's value depends on the future.
Professor Jaffe, what do you say about the bailout? They've got $700 billion in hand now to go at these assets and more, value them, buy a bunch of them from the banks, and hopefully put a floor under the economy and maybe the housing market too in that way. Does it sound workable?
Very, very difficult. The fundamental problem is that is how to value the assets. A typical situation today, for example, is you would have some mortgage-backed security, maybe with a principal, a full value of, let's say, $100. The bank has written it down on its books to $50, and the best quote you can get in the marketplace is $30. What is the Treasury supposed to do? Buy it at $30? Well, that's really not going to benefit the bank. They could sell it at $30. Value it at $50? Well, that doesn't seem very fair to the taxpayers. Why should we be paying $20 to subsidize a bank that's going to remain in business? And the Treasury has not announced the conditions under which it's going to do it, so we don't really know what's going to happen next. I would also say these securities are, each of them is unique. So it's not as if you're buying some standardized commodity and you can have an auction and you'll say, well, yesterday's price on gold was 800 and today it's 810, so we know the price. These things are, each of them are absolutely unique, and therefore there's going to be no standardization. It's a very difficult problem.
My house is different from your house, is different from her house, and on we go. There's no standard bar of gold here. It may not be gold at all. Susan Wachter, I want to talk about regulation, but before we do, I want to get a sense of where each of you is coming from. When you look at the core problem behind the big problem that we're in now, do you see it? There's one argument that's emerged in Washington that we pushed too hard to spread home ownership in this country and overshot. There's another big argument that says it was really scheming banks and finance institutions, you know, that sort of worked the angle so hard that they sucked people in here who shouldn't be in and got over their heads. How do you see the root of the problem?
Well, it's certainly possible that all the above are true.
Mm-hmm.
And identifying the important factors and the less important factors is going to take time, no doubt about it. Nonetheless, the incentives were absolutely there to get loans done, despite the fact these loans made no sense for the long run. So that has to be addressed no matter what.
But does that mean that fewer Americans are going to own homes? Are we going to see a real change in the ratio of ownership versus renters?
Well, one somewhat of a canard here. Actually, home ownership peaked in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
So the runoff of 2004-2005. So the runoff of 2005, 6, 7 was refinancing. Now home ownership today is back down to 2003. That overexpansion of home ownership is gone. We won't see that again. Those few points that were artificial from 2002, 2003 to for a few years,
mm-hmm.
that's gone. It's already gone.
It's out of the system. Then look forward, Dwight Jaffe. Near term, medium, long, what's required here?
Well, I think, and those are very different questions. What to do in the next, say, 18 months is basically a matter of how to deal with the current crisis and with possibly a recession that's soon to come. I think the government has adopted a very, very powerful tool. After all, we now own Fannie and Freddie, the two government-sponsored enterprises, We the People, that can now be used as an active tool of policy to make mortgages, to purchase mortgages on an ongoing basis to stimulate the real estate markets as best they can.
So in a way, we've nationalized the mortgage industry with that.
Well, 50% of it,
mm-hmm.
maybe probably 75% of it, because the half we didn't privatize, is half of it is dead. So,
mm-hmm.
yes, that's not an inaccurate characterization. If you look beyond, though, and say, let's suppose we can assume somewhere out there, let's say 2-3 years from now, the crisis will be over and we have to adapt to a new regulatory world, my position on that is we must re-regulate the entire financial system, both the investment banks, commercial banks, and mortgage sector, so that in the future the government, the Treasury, and the Fed do not feel they have to bail out institutions. In other words, we should leave one class of institutions that will not need bailouts, say hedge funds that just do their own thing, and if they lose money, it's their problem, and then other institutions which are fundamentally part of the infrastructure, the payment system, the counterparty system, and those we have to safeguard and regulate to a level that they can stand alone, that they will not be brought down by the next crisis.
So take that from look out 2-3 years. Let's say this new regulatory regime along the lines that you would suggest is in place. What would the changes look like, starting with here's a house, here's a couple buying it, as you know, the bank or mortgage broker who makes the deal, and take us up that change? What would be the regulatory change at each kind of level of that finance structure above it that you would see or push for?
Okay, well, I'm happy to. I think that's a very good question, and from a very practical standpoint, the borrower on Main Street, it actually won't look any different. You'll still be going into the same bank. You'll still be getting a mortgage. It'll still be securitized. All of the processes will be very much the same, but at each level, there's going to be safeguards that don't exist.
It'll still be already securitized, meaning that the loan will be sold on into some kind of bigger chain or world of finance.
Very likely, or at
okay.
least to some significant degree. But the very first stage,
mm-hmm.
we will the Federal Reserve, back in July, so this is already on the books, has announced very strong new rules on consumer protection, truth in lending legislation, so that many of the extremes that we saw in the form of predatory lending simply cannot and will not occur again. So there will be a class of borrowers who shouldn't have gotten loans in 2005 and 6, and they won't be eligible to get loans in 2009 and 10.
Liar loans and all that, where you didn't have to put down the honest, accurate, full information about income, et cetera.
Exactly. Literally, the new truth in lending laws prohibit a bank from making loans without that information.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly right.
Okay.
So it's on the books.
Presumably, Susan? Not only without that information, but having that information, no teaser rates, no negative amortization. Is that what you're saying, Dwight?
There are the new rules, the new truth in lending laws from the Fed, have lots of restrictions, particularly on high-rate mortgages that are more than 2% above the going rate, which limit the prepayment penalties, which limit negative amortization. Regular prime mortgages, the market is still able to function in a reasonable way. So I'm very much in favor of what the Fed did in July, and I think the next round of serious mortgage lending will have very little, if any, predatory patterns.
Let's be clear on that step first. Susan, do you agree that those guarantees are in place?
I'm absolutely in favor of the Fed's new regs. And, in fact, if they were in place, we would have avoided a great deal of what we're seeing today. Nonetheless, there is still room for disaster, even with those safeguards. And we can see that. We can even see that in the UK. The UK did not have the kind of predatory loans that we had.
Mm-hmm.
And they're in the middle of a crisis, not as severe, but a pretty, for them, difficult position to be in. And I am afraid that there is a fundamental flaw even in Dwight's very carefully laid out plan.
Okay, so what else? What more do you see is needed?
The problem is the securitization, and maybe Dwight has, I'm sure, many more details to safeguard against this. The securitization, if it's marked to model, as we say, that is, if there's an imprimatur that's given to the securitization from a firm, Moody's, let's say, or whatever, this is AAA, so that pension funds, widows and orphans throughout the world can bring their money to bear on this, and if there's regulatory slippage, that is, if there's erosion of standards, very difficult to tell over time, then we are back where we were before because there is no one taking the risk, no one owning the risk that that's going to happen.
Okay, you're taking us on up the chain there. You need to translate for us here then. Securitization meaning the loan is made and now gets packaged and sold on up to some bigger loan holders, and you want what kind of safeguards in that chain, in something as close to lay language as you can make it, because it's hitting all of us lay people.
Oh, absolutely. Someone has to pay for the risk for risky loans. Otherwise, there will be fees that are generated, and those loans will get made, and in the end, we will all bear the risk as those loans cannot be repaid.
And how do you guarantee that somebody's taking, that someone's accountable for that risk, that it lands on someone's bottom line, not just the public's? How do you do that?
Well, I'm very interested, Dwight. What are your thoughts on that? We have some, but this is your proposal.
Dwight Jeffy?
Yes, well, I do not believe that securitization was the fundamental flaw that created this crisis. It's just a mechanism for transferring assets from one party to another. The flaw in the process was the greedy investors at the end of the line who were leveraging their positions 30 and 40 to 1. So they were buying $100 worth of mortgages and putting in $2 of equity. And, of course, if they fall 2%, they're bankrupt, and then the Fed bails them out, and that's why we're sitting here today.
So how do we staunch that? How do we stop it? Never again.
That goes back to my proposal for re-regulating the financial system. If there are hedge funds that want to leverage at 30 and 40 to 1, we have to make sure that they, if they fail, and they will fail for sure, do it on their own capital, and they're out of the system, and the Fed and Treasury have no interest in bailing them out.
That sounds too simple, because what we've just heard in the last few weeks is they're too big to fail. We can't let them fail. If they do, they bring all the rest of us down with them.
We haven't had any hedge funds, pure hedge funds, fail where there's been any need for bailouts. No, the bailouts have all occurred in basically what were used to be called investment banks. Of course, we virtually have none of them anymore because they've either failed or merged into bank holding companies or in Goldman and Morgan, they chose to become banks. So the issue is in the commercial banking system, and there I would just regulate it very severely. And they cannot leverage to this extreme, and we would just have to regulate it so they could not.
Susan, does that sound like a solution? Can you let hedge funds do what they will as investors at the end of the line who would buy these things and then just go down if they failed to calculate their risk well? regulate the rest of it and have a system that works. Do you hear the outline of something workable there?
There's still a flaw. We had the Asian financial crisis coming straight out of the commercial banks, which were regulated. After all, Fannie and Freddie were regulated. They, too, were in crisis. And all of these are the real estate crisis of Japan, another example. The problem is you can limit leverage, and I'm absolutely agreeing with everything that Dwight has said to this point, but it's necessary but not sufficient. You can limit leverage, but what if the value of the underlying real estate is unsupportedly through a bubble going up so that it appears that the leverage is totally under control? If you looked at the leverage in the situation of the Asian financial crisis, other crises, it was not immediately apparent because the creation of the credit bubble itself drove housing prices up. So the fundamental loan-to-value, if you will, of the entire system did not look totally impossible to sustain when it actually was.
How do you avoid that risk if you're going to have securitization? That is, if you're going to take these loans and pass them up into a big chain of finance instead of keeping them at the local, you know, savings and loan, Jimmy Stewart style.
Well, for one, we had securitization for a long time without the securitization that we've seen now, this securitization bringing terror. We had securitization that was based off of risk of interest rates moving, not of default risk. Those are two different kinds of securitization. The world went perfectly well. We do not really need securitization of default risk. But if we do have it, and I'm not saying we shouldn't, whatever securitization we have, we need to make sure it's accountable. Those securities are tradable so that, in fact, there is someone taking a risk position on both sides, as opposed to someone saying, these are AAA, and we will have eventually the government coming in and standing behind them.
But the government standing behind it doesn't seem like an answer in and of itself, because that's where we are now, and it's costing us billions.
That's why we can't have, quote-unquote, mark to model. We actually have to have instruments. If these are securities, that's how we're creating, they have to be tradable. In this particular market, because this is housing, the problem with housing is that every house is different, every neighborhood is different. It's easily subject to bubbles when it's very difficult to price housing.
Dwight Jaffe, maybe this is the way, but it sounds to me like there's still enough play in it that it's hard to rebuild confidence.
I believe that the fundamentals of our real estate finance system will be recovered.
But you can't just say that after what we've just been through. You know, I mean, it's just too big and too expensive, and the knock-on effects are too brutal.
This is very strongly an aberration. The subprime lending, as we all know, was an extraordinarily, you know, silly, stupid, and extremely costly episode that will not be repeated. One cannot forget that the modern U.S. real estate finance system, which basically was created following World War II, basically has performed extraordinarily well for 50 years, say, to the year 2000. We have had this episode. We're going to learn from it. We will re-regulate the institutions. We've already, I think, re-regulated the lending process through this Truth in Lending. And I think in 2 or 3 years, people will certainly regain confidence when they go to their bank and they say, I want to buy this reasonably priced house, and I have a 30%, I can afford it on standard ratios.
Here's my down payment, here's my income, and off we go. Dwight Jaffe, please stand by in New York. Susan Wachter in Philadelphia. When we come back, we'll turn to our listeners with their questions. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking about American housing and finance today. What went wrong and how to fix it? Dwight Jaffe joins us from UC Berkeley and now at NYU visiting this semester. Susan Wachter is with us from the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, professor of finance and real estate there. Let's take a call from Robert in Stowe, Vermont. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Yes, I am.
What's on your mind?
What's on my mind is the foreclosures are the gasoline of the fire of this thing. We need a foreclosure holiday in the same sense that Roosevelt had a bank holiday. Every foreclosure has to be overseen by a referee who will be empowered to give the lender 80% of the value of the loan and renegotiate a loan with the person in the house at 90%, and we'll take the 10% as the cost of doing that business. And we'll, if they are unable financially to support that type of loan, then we should rent it to them. Foreclosures only give us vacant property that goes to the deteriorates other property, mm-hmm. and creates an increasing supply, which causes a decrease in price of housing, price of the assets.
A foreclosure holiday and then a kind of new deal on foreclosed properties and their financing. Susan Wachter, what do you say?
Robert is absolutely correct. We need loan modifications, and we need to keep people in their homes who are able and willing to pay at a more reasonable, at their current rate before the teaser goes up, before the option. If they've paid for the past 12 months, despite the fact that the value of their home is beneath the market value, that shows they are capable of paying and willing to pay. And we don't need their home on the market. We need a soft second so that when they do sell that home, the taxpayer, who's going to have to ultimately give them a cut for the short run at least, will get paid back.
Is there anything like that on the horizon? Anyone putting that forward concretely?
There is in the housing bill that was passed language which requires servicers, and of course the government is now going to own and be overseeing these many of these failing loans, to work towards loan modifications. The problem is the servicers are not today in a position to do so. We have a major logjam which is causing homes to go into foreclosure, which could be saved to benefit all of us.
Susan, what about the argument that's come out, particularly from Republican quarters in the last several days, loudly saying this all goes back to Community Reinvestment Act back in the 70s in an effort to extend home ownership into inner cities and so on? Do you see that as a legitimate criticism? Is that beside the point? How do you look at that?
Well, I think you just answered the question the way you've asked it. The Community Reinvestment Act goes back to the 1970s and the 1980s. This is a problem of 2003 forward, maybe 2002 forward. This is not a CRA event. Not to say that the language of home ownership for anyone, anytime, any place didn't hurt. That certainly added to the fuel to the fire.
Let's take a call from Gail in Augusta, Georgia. Gail, you're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is this, and I would like for someone to explain it, if they can.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that everybody's boxing this subprime, the mortgage, all this into one little box. And the real meltdown came from a lot of different sources. I.e., when I got into my mortgage, I could afford it barely, but at least I could afford it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as it turns out, I can barely pay the mortgage because all prices have gone up. Gas, food, because of the gas prices,
mm-hmm.
food has gone up.
Right.
And I think that it's all interconnected, and I really think that someone should address the elephant in the closet.
Yeah, blow open the box, you say. Gail, we'll do that. Dwight Jaffe, how about it? Gail was just making it. She feels like she could have gone on making it if it weren't for all the rising prices or her diminishing buying power around her mortgage.
There's really, I think, no simple solution to that. It's the economy is very sick, and we talk about it in the abstract in the headlines and unemployment rates and inflation rates. But when someone explains it at this level, of course, it's going to be true at each and every individual as well. There is no real easy fix here. Let me get, and this also relates mm-hmm. to the previous call, that while absolutely we want to have a way of modifying these loans to not to have the foreclosures, the details are almost impenetrable. And let me give you two problems.
Okay.
The first is equity across two different. Suppose you have two neighbors. They both bought their home at the same time. The Joneses were very fiscally careful. They saved their money, and they're still making their mortgage payments, and they intend to keep doing so. The Smiths across the street with the same house took a wonderful vacation, took out a second mortgage home equity loan, and bought a brand-new car, and they're now going into foreclosure.
Mm-hmm.
Is it fair that the taxpayers are going to help the Smiths and not the Jones? Really serious problem of equity. And all mortgage loans have this feature that people have different consumption patterns, and that leads to distress. The second problem is one of cheating. If you have a government program that now comes in and says, those that are unlucky enough to be in foreclosure are going to be given help. Well, then my friends, the Jones across the street, may decide they should just miss a few payments. Why shouldn't they get part of the same government program? And so you're going to make the problem actually worse in a sense.
So moral Very hazard difficult. And equity, fairness issues woven through here. Susan, can we negotiate that? Can we navigate that? And
difficult. Very difficult. But nonetheless, we may have to do it. Difficult, extraordinarily difficult problems. We sometimes have to do it. But we have to do it understanding just the problems that Dwight laid out on the table and dealing with as best we can. For example, ideally, to be eligible for these potential hand-ups, you have to have paid for the last 12 months. So we don't encourage that moral hazard. Now we're not going to pay. Secondly, you absolutely owe back when the home is sold what has helped you to stay in the house. But, you know, if we help the Smiths who are about to foreclose on the property, we're helping the Joneses as well, because the Joneses may need to move and they will not be able to sell their home with Smith's property on the market across the street selling at fire sale prices.
Now, what about Dwight's observation before the break saying, you know, this is a tremendous aberration. We will get back on keel here. Bring in some of the kinds of changes and tightened regulations he's describing, and we can feel confident that it won't happen again. Do you hear in the outline of a program that Dwight Jaffe is sharing with us the mechanics that would give you confidence that this would not happen again?
Unfortunately, no. We cannot say it's an aberration when we go back a little bit more than a decade to the Asian financial crisis, which was extremely serious for much of Asia as well as some other parts of the world as well. Go back another 7 years to 1990. We had the S&L crisis, which, by the way, there were worldwide throughout many of the economies of the world had similar crises. So an aberration, no, not maybe an aberration every 50 years, maybe even every 20, 30, but every 10 years, no, that's not an aberration.
So what's the safeguard that could be implemented against those kind of meltdowns, or is that just what comes with our system?
Well, no, it cannot come with our system. Our system cannot be allowed to self-implode. And I do believe that there are safeguards that can be put into place. It's not as though this is a random event. It's not that it's unlucky. It's that there is a system failure. There are, a technical word here, incomplete markets. Normally, economic markets work out. And normally, the individual decision-making in their own self-interest works out. But there is a system-wide failure here, a market failure, if you will, which has to do with the very difficulty of pricing and selling these idiosyncratic objects out there, which are our homes. So for that reason, we need to make sure we have the system in place that doesn't artificially boost the prices of home with credit that is not sustainable. I believe it's doable. We are going to have to put a lot of energy behind, one, identifying the problem, not just a few economists, but it's going to have to be widely understood. And then once it's understood, there will have to be in place an entire structure to make sure it doesn't happen again.
Give us a sense of what that structure would be. I mean, is it that obscure even to economists? Is there a fix that you can imagine, a regulation you could write in the next 5 minutes that we could put in federal law that would lay down some kind of wall against this?
Well, the short answer is if you could actually have regulation in place that would not pro-cyclically, that is, would not get easier over time and give this false illusion of housing prices increasing when they're not, if you could actually hold to that regulation, that would be an answer. But that's very difficult because we've seen that as the economy goes into a boom, everyone's thinking these are good times. Who's to say they're not good times? Who's to say that housing prices are too high? So it's very difficult to hold a regulatory line, and we've seen it over and over, many, many cases, many, many countries. That's got to be part of it. But in addition, we've got to have speed bumps. We've got to have, instead of throwing accelerants into the fire as monetary powers, Fed, do and saying, well, it's fine, we can ease up the regulation because we can trust markets, we have to have speed bumps so that when it appears as though housing prices are bubbling up, we begin to, right at that moment, prudentially, we inquire, we look, where is the funding coming from? Where is the credit coming from? Is this sustainable? Who is bearing this risk? And there's technical layers on this which we can go into. But after all, we had macroeconomic instability. We had the Great Depression. We had the worldwide inflation of the 70s. We understood that. We saw that. I am suggesting this is of that magnitude.
Is that fundamentally a philosophical critique you're making, a political critique, a critique against market fundamentalism, the view that markets will solve everything? Is that what crept in here and ground down the speed bumps?
I think there was a wishful thinking that markets are reliable, solve everything, but there is no economist who will subscribe to markets solve everything. So we could, you know, be in the blame-pointing game, but when the times are good, everyone is enjoying that. Everyone's enjoying that punch, and, you know, taking the punch bowl away is difficult for anyone.
I'm much more optimistic than this. let me first say that while Susan mentions a lot of financial crises, my statement was not that there won't. I certainly agree there will be more future financial crises like the Asian crisis, like the 1987 stock market crash. These things will happen.
You have to forgive us if we're not in the mood for that kind of observation just now. I mean, everybody's savings are being blown to smithereens and jobs are going out the window hand over fist. Is that really just, you know, part of the day's diet?
Yes. But the topic that's on our table right now is real estate finance. And I really feel that within 3 years, this system will be up and functioning quite normally. What you have to remember, but what that means is we're going to go back to the standard 20% down payment, 30-year fixed rate mortgage that drove our system and created the wonderful housing markets from 1950 to, say, to 2000. No problems, no major defaults. 20% down payment ratio is a very significant requirement, but it worked just fine. And there's just no reason we can't return to that. The reason Fannie and Freddie got into trouble is they violated that rule. They went into all kinds of junk mortgages.
Back to the future, maybe. Let's get a call from Fairhaven, Massachusetts. Lewis, you're on the air.
How are you doing?
Pretty well.
I've been listening to this, and I start from back to the very beginning when he said that it was illusion. I agree that this is illusion. I also hope that you'll agree that we got into the situation around these mortgages not because we haven't gone through this before. We went through Silverado. We went through the Keating. You know, we went through this failure.
Keating 5, SNL, and all the rest. So what now, Lewis?
Well, what now is that, you know, we need to talk about the fundamentals as there being regulation to stop, you know, this illusionary process. First thing, you know, we have to deal with the fact that the $700 or $900 billion dollars is not going for mortgages. Mortgages represents 45% of that bailout. We can pay off the bad debt in mortgages. Where's the rest of the money going?
You're talking about the bailout with the $700 billion?
It's $700 billion that we passed. I mean, it's not all going for mortgages, but we'll drop the issues on mortgages. But where's the rest of the money going? And we relegate it to mortgages. But the bottom line is we were here before, and if this could fix itself, we wouldn't be back here again. We're revisiting that. Now, the people who made the money, no one's asking the question, where'd the money go? When the inflation came to the market, where people were getting money, the folks who took their money from the top, They got paid for bringing the mortgages to the banks or bringing it to the subprime lenders. They got paid. But now what's happening is we got homes and we got the whole country in a crisis, and people got paid, and no one's asking the question, where did the regulations that were in place that were not adhered to, you know, who are the people watching the store? And
right. Lewis, our time is short, but thank you for your call. Susan, you know, winners and losers and a sense of inequity at the end of the game, and Lewis wanting to know, you know, how do we get some equity back into this system? These are questions that go right to the heart of sort of working with a market. When things get this wild, people ask really probing to the heart of the issue questions.
And those questions are entirely appropriate and need to be answered. But first, we have to get out of the crisis.
Do you think we're beginning to get our feet on the right path, Susan? Do you have Dwight's confidence that within 3 years we'll sort of be up and functioning, back in business? Is that a possibility? Can we do that? Can it be like it was you name the date, 3 years from now.
I do think we could be back 3 to 5 years. I would push it a bit. But I don't think, I certainly do not share Dwight's confidence that this was an aberration and we'll never see it again. I do think we have to go deep into the causes to make sure we don't see it again in 5 or 10 years, because we've seen similar crises coming out of real estate elsewhere. But I do think we can solve it, and I actually do believe there is the knowledge of the past depression. Bernanke is a student of that.
Mm-hmm.
The fact of the matter that we have global economy and that we have a global crisis at hand in some ways means that we have the attention of everyone meeting in Europe. We're going to need that. We're going to need coordinated response across the globe. We need it, and immediately, because things move very quickly in this new global economy.
Well, this country's going to have some big conversations and a lot of work ahead. That is abundantly clear here. We want to thank you both for lighting up the way. Susan Wachter at the Wharton School, thanks very much for being with us today.
Pleasure.
And Dwight Jaffe of NYU this fall and UC Berkeley. Professor Jaffe, thank you for joining us.
It's been delightful.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the OnPoint podcast at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.